You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the July-August 2021 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of Come Together by Joe Hagan. Last year, when Disney released a teaser for Get Back, meant to assuage expectant fans after the movie was delayed for a year because of COVID-19, the montage of never-seen footage showing Lennon gleefully horsing around the studio with McCartney, doing a comic version of Two of Us through clenched teeth, and Ono chatting warmly with McCartney's wife Linda Eastman, looked revelatory, astonishing, and a bit suspicious to fans with even a passing knowledge of Beatles history. Was Jackson cherry-picking moments of levity to sell a revisionist history? A whitewash? I don't think they'll feel that when they've seen it, Jackson says, but I understand where that's coming from. This is not what you read in the books. The books, of course, have long been in accord. The Let It Be sessions were a miserable time for the Beatles, an inflection point for their coming breakup, as Ono became a wedge between Lennon and the band, and Harrison yearned to break free from the mop-top machine, even quitting the Beatles at one point. In the weeks after the recordings, Lennon recruited manager Alan Klein to take over the band's business affairs, and McCartney hired his own father-in-law, attorney Lee Eastman, to counter Klein's machinations, leading to a vicious legal battle that lasted long after the band dissolved. In the aftermath, Lennon savaged the Let It Be sessions, telling Rolling Stone they were writing about Yoko looking miserable in the Let It Be film, but you sit through 60 sessions with the most big-headed, uptight people on earth and see what it's effing like and be insulted just because you love someone. And so went the story until 48 years later when Apple Corps CEO Jeff Jones and Apple executive Jonathan Clyde invited Jackson to their offices in London to discuss a traveling Beatles exhibition that would feature unrelated archival films. They asked Jackson whether he could update old footage using the same technology he used to revive vintage World War I reels for the acclaimed 2018 documentary They Shall Not Grow Old. When Jackson casually asked about the Let It Be movie, he was told that a separate project to make a new film from the Rushes was in the works, but that the original director had just dropped out. At this, Jackson perked up. So I just put up my hand and said, well, if you've just lost a filmmaker, I'm sitting here, I'll do it, he says. The Beatles exhibition never happened, but after Jackson reviewed the Let It Be footage twice, he realized he would be telling a much different story from the one most people understood. Unlike Ron Howard's 8 days a week, the touring years, the 2016 documentary about the mid-60s period before the Beatles, overwhelmed by fan mania, stopped playing live, Jackson's film isn't just a delicious peek at lost footage. Though it is that. It's an amendment to the received history. Though Get It Back is made for modern eyes decades after the events themselves, it's faithful to the intent of the original, which was to document the band's return to live performance after they ceased playing concerts in 1966. Director Michael Lindsay Hogue, the son of Irish actor Geraldine Fitzgerald, was the 28-year-old director of British pop music TV show Ready, Steady, Go when the Beatles asked him to produce a series of promotional movies for their 1968 singles. For a Hey Jude film, Lindsay Hogue brought in a small audience, a mix of young people and regular folk, like a village postman, to sing along to what would become a legendary chorus. The experience revived the Beatles' desire to play in front of people, and McCartney hatched a plan to make a TV show with taped performances of new Beatles songs before a small audience. The show would include a montage of behind-the-scenes verite footage of rehearsals. Paul was the driving force behind the whole project, says Lindsay Hoag. And so, on the second day of January 1969, the Beatles showed up at the cavernous Twickenham Studios in London to begin rehearsing songs for a TV show that would also be the basis of a live album. They chose Twickenham because Starr was shooting a movie there, The Magic Christian, co-starring Peter Sellers. At Twickenham, the Beatles rehearsed Get Back, Two of Us, and The Long and Winding Road, among others. And then, on day 7, Harrison walked out following arguments with McCartney. George quits, says Lindsay Hoag. Everything comes to a halt for a couple of days. And we're all sitting around and doing nothing much. And everyone's tetchy. Paul's tetchy. And then George will only come back if we go to Apple, the studio which they have in the basement. That little episode, he continues, has been taken and completely blown up by some people to represent acrimony between George and Paul and underlying severe tension. And in fact, it's just a small little cloud which passes over their working relationship in 5 minutes. That's all it was. But the conflict was a major pivot in the production. The TV show idea was scrapped, and instead Beatles management decided to expand the project into a feature film to fulfill a 3-picture contract that manager Brian Epstein had forged with United Artists before he died in 1967. The first two films were A Hard Day's Night and Help. Bowing to Harrison's demand, the Beatles moved the sessions to their recording studio at Apple, and Lindsay Hoag and crew continued shooting for a documentary. For his own film, Jackson decided that when Harrison and McCartney began fighting, a brief but tense scene in which McCartney placates a wounded Harrison after criticizing his guitar parts, he would show not only that, but the aftermath as well. Consequently, Jackson says, Get Back will be more revealing than the original, not less. It's a lot tougher movie than Let It Be, he says. I mean, Let It Be couldn't show George leaving the group, which he did on the 7th day, and then he obviously came back again. Let It Be never showed that. Jackson says he didn't need to manipulate Lindsay Hoag's original footage or include talking heads to contextualize things to create a dramatic film. The sessions formed their own story, and Get Back, he decided, could simply be a documentary about the documentary. If this was a fictional movie about a fictional band, having one of the band members walk out at the end of the first act, it'd be the ideal thing that you'd actually write into a script, says Jackson. So, weirdly enough, these guys are playing out their real life. They were not playing it out as a movie or a script. That was the truth of their life. And yet, somehow, in terms of these 21 days, it kind of weirdly fits it. And then the triumphant third act, where, against all odds, they're up on the roof playing. Fantastic. Lindsay Hoag needed a live performance for the climax of his documentary, so he and the Beatles bandied about possibilities. One involved an amphitheater on the coast of Africa at sunrise, with people streaming in like nomads arriving to the Holy Land. Another, encouraged by Lennon, imagined a concert on the deck of an ocean liner full of fans at sea. Ultimately, given the logistics and Harrison's reluctance to play live again, Lindsay Hoag proposed they go up to the roof of Apple Records and play an impromptu lunchtime concert. The band tentatively agreed, and support beams were built under the roof to hold the weight of the gear. But even in the moments before it was to happen, the band nearly didn't do it. As Lindsay Hoag describes in his memoir, Luck and Circumstance, the Beatles idled in the stairwell as McCartney tried rousing his bandmates. The six of us stood there, stasis about to set in, momentum about to be fatally lost, ennui about to settle its cloud on our beings. But one voice had not been heard from. Eyes under lids looked to that person, time froze. "F it," said John. "Let's do it." By the time Lindsay Hoag screened the first cut of the Let It Be movie for the band, the night Neil Armstrong walked on the moon, there were clear signs that the Beatles were fracturing. The day after the screening, an Apple executive called Lindsay Hoag to say there was perhaps too much Lennon and Ono footage in the movie. He said, "Well, let me put it this way. I've had 3 phone calls this morning," says Lindsay Hoag, "so I get the message that some of John and Yoko should come out." He recut the film, and it premiered in May 1970, by which time the Beatles had officially broken up. None of the band members showed up for the film's premiere in London, and history's judgment began to harden around Let It Be as a breakup documentary. When Lennon and Ono watched the final cut, with Rolling Stone founder Jan Wenner and his wife Jane in a movie house in San Francisco, they both wept while watching the rooftop sequence. In the decades since, the Let It Be film was essentially buried. After their breakup and the years-long financial and legal battles, the Beatles rarely agreed on much, but they did seem to agree that the Let It Be film was too bleak and emotionally painful to revisit. A significant technical issue also hampered any revival. In 1971, says Jackson, an Apple employee who worked in the Savile Row studio stole 140 hours of the audio, which left only a mono version used for the final cut of the film. The stolen tapes contained hours of sound recorded when the cameras weren't rolling, meaning there was potentially even more revelatory evidence to be unearthed. They eventually got Interpol involved, says Jackson. In the late 90s or early 2000s, they did a sting operation in Amsterdam and recovered all of the tapes, apart from 40. There was about 560 quarter-inch tapes. There are still 40 missing, but we managed to find some of that sound through other sources. As Apple has released more archival material in recent years, the historical perspective of the Let It Be era has shifted. Mark Lewisohn, the foremost Beatles scholar in the world, spent a month listening to the nearly 98 hours of studio recordings the Beatles made in January 1969, and, like Jackson, was amazed by what he discovered, declaring, "It completely transformed my view on what that month had been." Far from a period of disintegration, says Jackson, these 3 weeks are about the most productive and constructive period in the Beatles' entire career. The tracks you hear on Let It Be were recorded during this 3-week period. The band also rehearsed 3/4 of the Abbey Road album, about half of Harrison's All Things Must Pass album, a half dozen songs that would later appear on McCartney's solo albums, and a couple that would show up on Lennon's. It was, Jackson marvels, the Beatles doing these. Last year, McCartney told the Sunday Times that seeing uncut footage from Get Back was a relief, precisely because it countered his lingering guilt over the breakup of the Beatles. "It was so reaffirming to me, because it proves that my main memory of the Beatles was the joy and the skill. I bought into the dark side of the Beatles breaking up and thought, oh God, I'm to blame. I knew I wasn't, but it's easy when the climate is that way to start thinking so. But at the back of my mind, it was always this idea that it wasn't like that, but I didn't see proof." After talking to McCartney in New Zealand, Jackson went to Starr's home in Los Angeles to show him the footage on an iPad. He was laughing, I was laughing, and began corresponding with Olivia Harrison, George's widow, who threw her support behind the film despite the documentation of George's discontent. "She saw the rooftop concert about the same time as Paul did," says Jackson. "She's seen it about 7 or 8 times since. She's very supportive." But what of Ono? For decades, she was a vigilant and astute gatekeeper of John's legacy, a powerful and opinionated voice among the 4 parties who control how Beatles music and history is curated and reissued. McCartney, in interviews, has tried to correct Ono's storyline that her late husband was the most important Beatle, the true genius of the band. As he told me in 2015, once John got murdered, he became the martyr, the Buddy Holly, the James Dean character. Because of the atrocity it was, a revisionism started to go on, and Yoko certainly helped it. There's no denying that the first cracks in the Beatles' facade had already appeared by the time of the Let It Be sessions, and that both fans and the press saw Ono as a bête noire in the plotline. For Get Back, Jackson says, Lennon's son Sean represented the Lennon estate and watched the rooftop sequence in London last year. Ono's current status is unclear, but Jackson says he isn't beholden to anyone's agenda and has had control over the final cut of the film. I have gotten no edicts, he says. I mean, nobody from Apple, none of the Beatles, have told me what to do, or none of them have said to me, don't show this, don't show that. I've been given no censorship instructions at all. I've been completely left alone. Next photo. Long winding road. McCartney in the control room. And other photos. Harrison. Star taking a break. The Beatles' last concert ever on the roof of Apple headquarters. Jackson is cognizant of the delicacy of a project in which he second-guesses another filmmaker's creative decisions. He met with Lindsay Hoag in Los Angeles in 2020 to show how his technology could transform the footage. He showed me a comparison of my Let It Be footage and his stuff, says Lindsay Hoag, including how McCartney's hair appeared as a single block of color in the original, and now you can see every single strand of hair. Lindsay Hoag defends his own film as more original and up than people remember. He also says that Apple asked for his goodwill toward Jackson's film, which he looks forward to seeing, and that he feels it's Apple's intention to possibly re-release Let It Be a few months after Jackson's Get Back comes out. Quentin Tarantino's movie theater in Los Angeles, the New Beverly Cinema, has expressed an interest in screening Let It Be if it's re-released, he says. As for Jackson, he's developed a deeper admiration for the original, in part because of the circumstances under which Lindsay Hoag labored, what with an increasingly acrimonious band hovering around him. The Beatles that I'm dealing with now are Beatles that can't remember January 69, Jackson says. I mean, they literally can't. Not really. And I don't blame them. In a decisive and crucial creative act, Jackson says he avoided repeating footage from the original film. Even familiar scenes would use alternative camera angles. One of our mantras is that Let It Be is one movie, and our movie is a different movie, he says. And we're trying not to repeat any footage, with one or two tiny exceptions where we can't do anything else. But we're trying to not step on Let It Be's toes, so that it is still a film that has a reason to exist, and our movie will be a supplement to it. 51 years after the group broke up, Jackson's film is probably the last revelatory document we're likely to see. That it also documents their last official album gives it a bittersweet power. Fans and scholars will likely debate whether Get Back is a revision of history or a correction. But it's something everyone craves. More Beatles. Says Jackson, Paul said to me at one stage, look, this stuff's fantastic, because at the end of the day, I'm a Beatles fan.
Thank you.
the murders at Fort Hood. The remains of soldiers have been turning up around the Texas military base with terrifying frequency, but the only link among the victims may be the institution that trained them all to kill, by Mae Jong, with photographs by Devin Oktor Yalkin. Opening photo is a black and white photograph, and it's an aerial shot showing trees. Additional photos, the fallen, Gregory Waddell Morales, Vanessa Guillen, and Elder Fernandez are among those whose deaths raise questions about Fort Hood. Part 1. The Mysteries. The numbers are distressing. Last year, at least 39 Fort Hood soldiers died or went missing. 13 killed themselves. 5 were murdered. 11 of the deaths remain unsolved. Some legally, others for the victims' families. The 2020 numbers add to ongoing mysteries, including a 2016 case where a corpse's hyoid, the U-shaped neck bone, typically examined to determine whether strangulation has occurred, was missing. These figures eclipse American casualties in Afghanistan and Iraq in the same year. The suicides, which reportedly jumped by as much as 20% across the military last year, work out to a rate of one soldier a month. And yet, the data is not really out of the ordinary for U.S. military bases. Last December, a Special Forces soldier and an Army veteran were found dead at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, where another soldier disappeared in May and was later found murdered. In 2018, a soldier was allegedly shot and killed in her front yard by her husband at Fort Campbell in Kentucky, which also has one of the highest rates of suicide in the Army. In 1941, Private Felix Hall was lynched by fellow soldiers at Fort Benning, Georgia. His killers were never looked for properly and thus never found. Fort Hood might not even stand out were it not for a particularly bad year among many. The stories are gruesome, then heartbreaking, then beyond belief. Staff Sergeant Devin Schwett was found dead in his pickup truck, fitted with a hose running from the exhaust pipe to the cabin in January 2016. The death was ruled a suicide, despite the fact that the blanket stuffed around the window to hold the pipe in place had been doused in Schuett's own blood, and Schuett was found with 9 stab wounds across his body, including his forearm and his left hand. Schuett's body was returned to his family wrapped like a mummy. Later that year, Private Dakota Lee Stump left his barracks to report for work less than a mile away, but never arrived for formation. His body was found nearly a month later, 2 miles from the barracks. Fort Hood announced that Stump had crashed his car while driving under the influence, though a toxicology report proved inconclusive. Stump was going 82 miles per hour in a 30-mile-per-hour zone, the investigation report said, and had hit a tree on a mound. No skid marks were apparent, nor did anyone hear the crash. His body was mostly intact, but for his hyoid, which was never found. Marine Lance Corporal Riley Schultz's death on March 15, 2019, at Camp Pendleton in San Diego County, was also ruled a suicide, despite his hyoid being broken. When the family exhumed his body in November 2020 for want of a second opinion, the independent autopsy revealed that the bone had, in fact, gone missing. Specialist Justin Ogden's death in July 2017 was ruled a suicide, but the suicide note Fort Hood produced as evidence did not match his handwriting, according to his mother, Tony. On March 5, 2020, Destiny Sawyer's 5-year-old daughter found her father, Specialist Christopher Sawyer, 29, after he had shot himself dead in the bedroom of their Fort Hood housing. The base might have continued to devour its soldiers had it not been for a missing soldier's family whose rage, love, and devotion would attract the attention of the media, celebrities, and later the White House, sparking congressional and military investigations. Fort Hood is one of 800 United States military bases around the world, the third largest in the country. American military bases once established seldom shutter, and Fort Hood, which started operating during World War II, has remained open for business. Its 218,000 acres spreading across two counties in central Texas near an otherwise unremarkable town called Killeen. From here, wars are launched. Military bases are the last piece of the homeland that soldiers see before they are deployed to fight and the first glimpse of home when they return. Driving into Killeen last fall, what greeted me was a deer, roadkill, that had been severed in half. Next, I passed Club Dreams, where specialist Shelby Jones was shot, bled out, and died last March. Then Guns Galore, where Army psychiatrist Major Nadal Hassan purchased a semi-automatic pistol that he would use to kill 13 people in 2009. A soft October wind carried the first chill of the season. During the day, though, it was still hot enough that if you dropped a beer bottle, the contents appeared to dry on contact. The vast emptiness that is most of the state can make you feel inconsequential, as if you could disappear, and no one would know you have ever lived. Traveling in the time of plague, trying to build rapport with people from 6 feet away, was enervating. So much of reporting is opening yourself up to chance. And there I was, compulsively locking and relocking the rental car door. On most nights, I had nightmares. My caution wasn't entirely unfounded. Terry Boley, whose daughter Candace became addicted to crack cocaine while serving at Fort Hood and was murdered in a motel room in 2011, told me not to drink the water. The Boley case remains unsolved. Thomas Berg, whose son Private Brandon Rosecrans' Jeep was found burning in May, told me not to go out after dark. His son's alleged killer is in custody awaiting trial. Next photos. After the storm, Mayra Guillen, Vanessa Guillen's sister, wraps her arms around her mother, Gloria. And hallowed ground, Temple, Texas, where a rail worker discovered Fernandez's remains. Linda Schwiers, whose specialist son, Justin, died in a car crash in June while suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, wanted me to be careful of cartels, which she said ran the area. Specialist Vanessa Guillen's father, Rogelio, wondered if I shouldn't carry a gun. Guillen's youngest sister, Lupe, made me promise to stay at the Marriott, a hotel she considered safer than the rest. I felt a bad vibe there, Lupe says, referring to Fort Hood. One of the first times she stepped onto the base, a rosary she had been carrying in the palm of her hand tore apart, its beads scattering over the concrete ground. At first blush, such violence at a base that calls itself the Great Place may seem extraordinary, inexplicable even. But then certain details start illuminating the mystery. That one out of three women soldiers have experienced sexual harassment, according to a recent survey. That gun safety is a distant concern in a community where the Second Amendment tops the Maslow charts. That psychological trauma among veterans vastly exceeds physical wounds. That most soldiers enlist when they are still teenagers, their yet unformed minds taught to kill. That American imperialism is imploding and the blast force radiates inward. Part 2. The Cruel Summer. On Wednesday, April 22, 2020, Guillen reported for duty at Fort Hood. The 20-year-old small arms specialist, then a private first class, was supposed to be off that day, so she showed up in civilian clothes, black tee, purple leggings, and a fanny pack. That morning, Guillen had left her third-floor barracks and headed downstairs to her workstation at the motor pool, a vast garage for military vehicles. She filled out the paperwork that is the lifeblood of the Army before heading toward the arms room a few paces away. Just before noon, Guillen left her keys, Army ID, and bank cards in one arms room and entered another adjacent arms room separated by a hallway. There, she encountered Specialist Aaron Robinson, also 20 years old, but a rank above. Robinson gave Guillen the serial number for a 50-caliber machine gun that needed servicing. Later, Robinson would tell investigators that Guillen completed her task and exited the building. Robinson himself left soon thereafter, he would testify, to spend the night off post with his girlfriend. Nearly 200 miles away in Houston, Rogelio Guillen was entering his fourth hour of work at a nickel plating factory when he felt a sharp spasm in his chest. The wave of pain went away as suddenly as it had come on, but returned again and again and again over the next hour. He wondered if it was something he had eaten and carried on with his shift. He got home around 2 p.m. and told his wife Gloria about the unusual aches. Their minds both turned to Vanessa, whose hourly text to family members had gone silent. She had also missed her standing noon call with her fiancé, Juan Cruz. After 8 p.m., Guillen's sister Mara called the base. Guillen's superior confirmed she was missing. At 9:30 p.m., Mara, Cruz, Guillen's other sister Giovanna, and Giovanna's boyfriend set out for Fort Hood. Mara wept during the journey, already fearing the worst. Next photo, Force Field, Burnebeck Gate, the main entrance to Fort Hood. It rained that night, and the drive, which should have taken 3 hours, was slow going. The search party arrived at Fort Hood at 3 a.m., Guillen's staff sergeant told the group to come back in the morning. They checked into a nearby hotel and returned at 8 a.m. the next day. A group of soldiers, including Robinson, greeted them. The soldier said that Guillen's belongings had been found in the arms room, but otherwise she had left no trace. The family began posting online about Guillen's disappearance and distributing missing flyers. Back in Houston, Gloria recalled a conversation with her daughter not long before, when Guillen had been home for the weekend. Gloria had noticed her losing weight and pressed her for why. Guillen confessed that she was being harassed by another soldier. "Give me the name and I will report the bastard," Gloria told her daughter, who refused to tell her mother more for fear of worrying her, and also Gloria later suspected for fear of reprisal. This memory, now refreshed, Gloria began asking around for a name and soon learned it through Guillen's friend, Aaron Robinson, the last person to have seen her daughter. On May 19th, military investigators went through Robinson's phone and learned that he had called his girlfriend, Cecily Aguilar, multiple times on the night of April 22nd, as late as 3:30 a.m., from a town 20 miles east of Fort Hood. Despite his claim, he had been with Aguilar that night. Two witnesses had seen Robinson roll a black cargo box out of the arms room and through the parking lot, where he loaded it into his car and drove away, contradicting an earlier affidavit from three soldiers who falsely claimed they had seen Guillen departing the arms room earlier. The day after Guillen disappeared, Private Gavin Chambers, 21, died on base. On April 29th, it was Private Joshua Barnwell, 19. Sergeant Brad Reynolds, 37, killed himself on May 16th. On May 18th, Brandon Rosencrans' burning Jeep was discovered in a hilly suburb east of Fort Hood. Rosencrans, shot 4 times, was found 3 miles from his vehicle. The coming months brought the suicides of Staff Sergeant Richard Harrington, 45, and then Specialist James Green, 23. And on June 19th, skeletal remains were found in a field behind a cul-de-sac of a residential neighborhood in Killeen. Those remains, it turned out, belonged to yet another soldier, Private Gregory Waddell Morales, who had gone missing the previous summer. That September, Waddell Morales, who was from rural Oklahoma, was due to be honorably discharged from the military. The plan, Waddell Morales told anyone who would listen, was to use the GI Bill to attend technical school in Houston to work on wind turbines or oil rigs off the coast of Louisiana. On the night of August 19th, Waddell Morales went out to Club Fuego, located in a desolate strip mall about 10 miles east of Fort Hood. The next day, Waddell Morales failed to show up for duty, and the day after that, he was classified as absent without leave, making him one of the 1,000 or so soldiers who go AWOL in any given year. Since being stationed at Fort Hood in November 2016, Waddell Morales had frequented the Dollhouse, a strip club not far from where his remains would eventually be found. At the Dollhouse, he got to know Penny Morales, a dancer and mother of two. They married in May 2017, and he took her name with hyphenation. Penny says they met online. Waddell Morales was thrilled to become a father. The new family, like more than 70% of all Fort Hood service members, lived off post, but after 2 dead bodies were found on their street, they moved into base housing. By then, Waddell Morales had grown distant from his family in Oklahoma, who had not been told of the marriage. His mother, Kim, only heard from her son when he needed money. By then, the Army, it seemed, had stopped providing Waddell Morales with a sense of purpose, and he had turned to alternate sources of meaning, namely car and motorcycle clubs, and life beyond the base. Most of the groups were above board, even as they were ruled by certain strictures for meeting attendance, dress code, and how to appropriately signal respect. Failure to comply could incur fines of hundreds of dollars, or other more severe social censure. A small minority, which bikers call 1% groups, and which the Department of Justice calls by the regrettable acronym OMG, or Outlaw Motorcycle Gangs, were the people Waddell Morales had been hanging around with. When Kim called Fort Hood inquiring after her son, she was told the case was the remit of the Killeen Police Department, as Waddell Morales had gone missing off base. But when Kim called the police, they dismissed her, telling Kim that her son probably just took off. Killeen police stated they have no knowledge of anyone declining to investigate. So when, the following spring, Fort Hood offered a $15,000 reward for information about Guion, then raised it to $25,000 in June, Kim called to demand the same. Fort Hood hurriedly put up a $25,000 reward for Waddell Morales as well. 4 days later, an anonymous tip directed investigators to an urban prairie at the end of a residential street where Penny Morales used to live. There, Waddell Morales' remains had been found, long ago decomposed in the Texas heat. The person who called in with the tip declined to collect the reward. Waddell Morales' death was not the first from the base that may have involved bike gangs. 2 days after Staff Sergeant Anthony Lovell, 40, disappeared in 2017, his body was found, eyes pecked clean, face split in half, in a creek off Killeen's seedy main corridor called Rancier. The same street where Specialist Freddy De La Cruz, 23, was shot and killed last March. The Lovell case was ruled an accident, despite the fact that a rival club's biker vest Cuddy, was found hanging neatly from a tree near the crash site, while his motorcycle, mirror, taillights, was found intact. According to Killeen police, no such vests were found at the scene of the crash. On July 3rd, a fortnight after Waddell Morales' body was found, specialist Miguel Yazzie, 33, died at Fort Hood after his repeated request to see a doctor were denied, according to Karma Johnson, whose brother died at Fort Hood. On August 13th, Staff Sergeant Bradley Moore died during a land navigation exercise on the base. His wife, Crystal, was denied her husband's mobile phone, the final investigation report, and even his corpse, until Texas Congressman Ron Wright stepped in on that front. Fort Hood does not count Moore in its official casualty list, as he was a member of the National Guard. On August 17th, Sergeant Elder Fernandez, 23, disappeared. Fernandez had just been stationed at Fort Hood in January. He had been happy enough there that in February he reenlisted for an additional 4 years. On May 11th, however, Fernandez reported to Fort Hood abusive sexual contact from a staff sergeant whom he alleged groped him in a supply room, according to the redacted military investigation report. Fernandez transferred to another unit, where he was called a snitch, and worse. On August 11th, a higher-up called Fernandez's mother, Ailina, to tell her that her son had not shown up for work for 2 days. Frantic, she called around to no avail. Eventually, Fernandez rang from the Army hospital. Fernandez wouldn't share much, nothing about what had caused him to be hospitalized, and said that he was using an insecure base hospital line. A few days later, they spoke again, for the last time. As soon as I get out of the hospital, I will call you. I will tell you everything. Fernandez was dropped off at his friend's house the next day, August 17th, never to be seen again. When Ailina contacted the military police at Fort Hood, they told her that Fernandez was an adult and that if he was missing, he likely didn't want to be found. If she wanted to pursue things further, they advised, she would have to file a missing persons report with the local police. The police, too, told Ailina that Fernandez was an adult and that they would not report him as missing. The police opened an investigation on August 19th. When Ailina offered the Fort Hood authorities the contents of her son's car, including a laptop, iPad, and external hard drive, they declined to investigate further. I am astounded nobody is interested, the Fernandez family lawyer, Lenny Keston, told me. Is it possible Elder was murdered? Is it possible Elder killed himself? It's possible. Don't they care as to what happened to Elder Fernandez? If he killed himself, don't they want to know why? On August 25th, a rail worker in Temple, Texas, 26 miles east of Fort Hood, saw a body hanging from a tree across from a burned-out warehouse near the tracks. The corpse had been dead for a while, though it was impossible to determine exactly how long. Soon after, the Temple police, who led the investigation, ruled Fernandez's death a suicide. The very next day, a Fort Hood investigation concluded that Fernandez's charges of sexual assault were unsubstantiated. Fort Hood also stated that it had completed an exhaustive search for Fernandez and that it had interviewed all relevant parties, including the family. Fernandez's family told me they have never been interviewed. Barely a week later, Private Carlton Chi, 25, died during training. Chi, like Yazzie, was a member of the Rama Navajo Indian Reservation community and was new to the base. Next photo, at rest. Flags frame the trail leading to the site where Guillon's remains were found in Killeen, Texas. Within days of arriving at Fort Hood, Chee's clothes were stolen. He told his sister there were three white soldiers who did not like him. On August 28th, Chee was called into a training run. He had messaged his sister beforehand to tell her something felt off. During the run, Chee, who had no pre-existing health conditions, collapsed. When his parents rushed to the hospital, they saw that Chee, lying unconscious, had bruises and scrapes on his chin and on both sides of his face. There was a deep cut above his left eye and cuts all over his legs. Basic details of the incident kept changing. First, it was a 5-mile run, then it was a 2-mile run. There had been a few people, then it was a group run of 11. Chee had joined the military in part to support the young family he was starting with his high school sweetheart turned fiance. He also wanted an education, and joining the army, he knew he could take care of all that, his sister Karma Johnson says. He died the evening of September 2nd. Fort Hood concluded Chee had died in training. Part 3, Killeen, Texas. Fort Hood was founded in January 1942 as a training ground for tank destroyers selected for its varied terrain. The area east of Killeen was built on 109,000 acres of high bluffs, ridges, sharp slopes, and mesa-like hills covered with mesquite and chaparral. It was also an ancient Comanche Native American burial ground, discovered when construction workers unearthed more than 2,200 grave sites in 1998. The tributaries that run through Fort Hood flow into the Leon River, where Guillon's remains were later found. Before Fort Hood was built, the land was used for grazing by some 3,000 farmers and ranchers, according to Gerald D. Skidmore, a Killeen historian. Hazel Buck Blackwell, whose family lost their farm, homestead, barns, orchards, and adjoining land when the base took over, said the closest thing might be the unexpected death of someone you loved very much. It was a heart-rending, searing experience, Central Texas historian Gradel Duncan said, leaving lifetime marks on all, and actually killing some, from the psychic devastation that followed. More than 2,200 trials over land rights commenced. The base was named after John Bell Hood, a Confederate general from a family that enslaved people in Kentucky, who made his name by breaking a Union line at Eltham's Landing in Virginia, and who, by today's standards, likely suffered from PTSD. Hood was an unsuccessful battle commander. 400 men of his Texas Brigade died in a single fight, some would argue through incautious direction. In other battles, having lost the use of his arm and later a leg, Hood had to be strapped to a horse for combat. He died in 1879, leaving a troubled legacy that is only now beginning to be questioned. The small Texas frontier town was also a hotbed of Klan activity, according to Texas historian Gene Bruce of the University of Houston, so much so that when the trains stopped in Killeen, black passengers, relegated to colored cars, knew to pull down their window shades to avoid a pelting with rocks by locals. There were no black residents in town until the early 1950s. Atop these sedimentary layers of desecration, displacement, and disorientation, the War Department set out to build a base that would go on to serve as a footnote to nearly every war in modern memory. Korea, Vietnam, Bosnia, Iraq, and Afghanistan, but also Grenada, Panama, and the Cuban Missile Crisis. It installed 35 firing ranges, 18 chapels, 3 bowling alleys, and 1,384 barracks that would house, at its peak, 95,000 soldiers, the most densely populated military base, at a cost of $35 million. Killeen itself sits on an especially brutal stretch of Central Texas along the Balcones Fault, which separates the high plains of the hill country to the west from the Grand Prairies and limestone plains of the east, and along which runs Interstate 35. Killeen was named after another disappointing man, Frank Killeen, an assistant general manager to the Gulf, Colorado, and Santa Fe Railway. It is unclear if Killeen even bothered to visit his namesake town, which by the early 1880s comprised 40 people living across 360 acres, mostly working in the two cotton gins, two grist mills, and two saloons. It had the most saloons, gamblers, and shootings per capita in Bell County, according to historian Martha Bomer. From this inauspicious start, Killeen grew into a proper military town and is now home to 6 strip clubs, 18 pawn shops, 35 dollar stores, and 38 tattoo parlors. Not long after Fort Hood opened, soldiers began bringing home souvenirs in the form of war brides. First came the British and Germans. Later came Koreans, Japanese, and Vietnamese, who still run sushi and pho restaurants in Killeen. They are part of Killeen's population of 151,000, many transient and very young, two-thirds of whom have military ties. That an overwhelming majority of the town's economy comes from Fort Hood makes Killeen a kind of rentier state, in that most of its revenue comes through a foreign entity, which historically has led to the collapse of domestic industries, leading to increased dependence on a single source of income, namely the military. This negates civic participation, as the state no longer needs to collect taxes and thus stops serving the people, who in turn have no need to pressure the government for anything. The very dynamic that continues to play out in oil-rich Gulf states. Fort Hood contributed nearly $30 billion to the Texas economy in 2019, according to the Texas Comptroller's Office. The pursuit of happiness, or simply stability, will invariably lure people to the American military, which may be why the undocumented, the indigent, or those with a criminal record are overrepresented in its ranks. Among 1.29 million members of the U.S. military, 65,000 are immigrants, according to the Washington Post. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair B airs on special subchannel receiver Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.